Today on Maine Calling, help with our gardens. We humans may not have enjoyed this rainy spring, but our hostas, ferns, peonies, daffodils, and many other beloved spring bloomers thrived in it. Now we have some sunshine and warm temperatures. Let's hope our vegetables follow suit. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we bring you one of our most popular shows of the season, gardening tips. Did you put your tomatoes in over the weekend, or are you holding off? Are you worried about emerald ash borer or other destructive pests? Is this the year you plan to tackle the invasive vine choking your shrubs? Maine State horticulturist Gary Fish and Lynn Holland from the UMaine Cooperative Extension are here to answer your questions. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Summer is on the way, and so are all the joys and challenges of Maine gardening. Here to talk garden strategies, pest management, lawn care, and other topics of the season, Gary Fish, who is Maine's state horticulturist with the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, and Lynn Holland, horticulture and social media professional at the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. We invite you to join the conversation. We know you have questions. What do you want to know about native plants, backyard pests, watering, pruning, you name it? A brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. A quick note, these gardening programs are usually very popular. Please do not wait until the end of the program to ask your question because we may not get to you if you wait that long. So we're going to start with a couple really important topics. Gary, I'll start with you. First, the status of the emerald ash borer, which is so destructive and has already decimated the ash tree population in many other states. We know that this has been in Maine since 2019. Where is it today?
Thanks for asking that, Jennifer. It's too bad that we are seeing this pest move quite long distances recently. We just found it in Bar Harbor, and the closest infestation to that we would think would come from that direction is in Bath, Brunswick. So it's obvious that someone probably moved that with firewood or something like that. And then the most recent find was in Belfast. So it's kind of in between those two locations. And, you know, it really is causing a lot of damage, especially in southwestern Maine. We're seeing lots of trees starting to die now. And it's really sad. And, you know, hopefully we can not spread it around any faster than we have to. It only moves about 2 or 3 miles on its own. And when it jumps that many miles, we know that, you know, probably someone has moved it themselves.
When you say moved it themselves, brought in firewood that has it.
Most likely that's the way it gets moved is in firewood. So we ban firewood from out of state coming into state. But also if you're in an area where emerald ash borer is under quarantine, which is most of southern Maine, and now all of MDI and the Belfast and Bangor area, you should not be moving firewood out of there and taking it to other places where we don't already have emerald ash borer.
Gary, I was on the department's website and looking at the map that shows in which community emerald ash borer has been spotted and also in what year. And it really struck me that this year, 2025, many new towns, not only Bar Harbor and Belfast, like you mentioned, many counties, many towns in Androscoggin County, many towns around the Sebago Lake area, the Kennebunks. It seems to me as though this is accelerating in spread. I mean, could you characterize it for us?
Yeah, it really does start to accelerate after it really gets a good foothold. And now, you know, pretty much all the towns in York and Cumberland counties are all filled in. So we know that it's moved throughout those areas. And like you said, around the Sebago Lake area, there's a lot of fines there. Some of that's due to the fact that there's a lot of professionals that give reports. And there's also a lot of folks that have learned what the signs are, and they're definitely something you can find on maine.gov/EAB. And, you know, especially in the wintertime, you can see where the woodpeckers have taken the outer bark off the ash trees, and it all deposits on the snow, and it's easy to see that way. But really, that southwestern corner of Maine is where you're going to see it just continue to chug along, and a lot of trees are going to start dying.
And people can inoculate their trees. Thanks to you, we have a beautiful ash tree on our property. We inoculated it and it seems to be thriving. But I've seen other trees in my neighborhood, in my town, that do not have buds. And it's making me really sad. But can you talk about what people can do and at what point it's too late?
Yeah, so if you don't have an ash tree that's already showing a lot of signs of being affected, so maybe a few of the top branches are dead. They're just starting to leaf out now in kind of central Maine. They're probably pretty well leafed out in southern Maine. But if you then, you know, have an ash that every year it's been leafing out completely, and you see four or five branches that aren't leafing out, or maybe you start to see some sprouts at the stump, that's a sign that it's pretty well infested and it's probably too late to do any kind of treatment for it. There are treatments that can be done. The most common one is emamectin benzoate, which is injected into the tree and will last about 3 years. So you only have to do it every 3 years. It is fairly expensive. So it's going to be those specimen trees that are really important to you that you want to save. Or in some instances, like for the Native American population, they love ash trees. It's part of their creation story. They're hoping to save seeds. So in some instances, some seed trees are being treated to save those for a longer period of time to allow for seed collection.
All right. And the other, I'm not sure quite how to characterize these. The other enemy of the moment, I guess we would say, is the jumping worm. I know last time we talked to you last year, Gary, you had been inundated with phone calls about jumping worms. Are you getting those calls again this year?
So jumping worms are Amenthes worms. That's their genus. There's a couple different species in Maine. So last year, we didn't get hit with quite so many calls. It was the year before that we had many, many, you know, hundreds that were confirmed, over 300 that were confirmed, many towns in pretty much every county except for Aroostook and Piscataquis have been confirmed. And, you know, it definitely is something that we're trying to keep track of. We don't know exactly how bad they are in, say, someone's vegetable garden or ornamental gardens. We know that they can be very destructive in the forest. And that's probably our biggest concern at this point, but also for the gardens. And, you know, we do have a big session coming up online, a two-day session, June 17th and June 18th, that people can register for on our website that has all of the regional and even international experts that are researching jumping worms are going to be on that two-day, two-afternoon webinar from Canada, Minnesota, Michigan, Virginia, UVM, Yale. So if you really want to learn about what's going on with them, that's where
if
to
you
go.
Think you have them in your garden, do you want to know, Gary? Do you want people to contact your department?
We do. So there is a place where you can report jumping worms to us. If you go to the jumping worm report form and you find that your town has already been reported, then we're not as anxious to get that report. But if you're a new town, then we do want to get that report, and we want you to provide a picture, and then we can get back to you to confirm the identification.
Well, Lynn Holland, turning to you, Memorial Day weekend is the traditional start of vegetable gardening season in Maine for many people. As people plant their vegetable gardens right now, you would encourage them to plant a little extra, correct?
Correct. And I just want to remind folks, we had a very early Memorial Day. So if you're planting your warm season vegetables, take a thermometer out and make sure the soil's warmed up, especially those folks in northern Maine. We're finding folks want to get their tomatoes out there. You might want to wait a week or so for that.
What does the thermometer need to say?
You want that soil to be above 55 degrees. And I know a lot of folks aren't seeing even 50 degrees yet in their soil. So they might have to wait till June 1st.
All right. But yes, so you'd like people to plant a little bit extra.
Yeah, please do plant a little extra. We used to, probably 25 years ago, that saying plant a row for the hungry came out, and it was from the Garden Writers of America. And then that grew in our area to the Harvest for Hunger program. And our Harvest for Hunger program in the last 25 years has gotten and harvested 4.1 million pounds of produce and given it away to the people of Maine. So, you know, if you can and you have the space, and we all know there's no chance you could ever buy too many plants. So, you know, if you're looking at that extra six pack of peppers or tomatoes or zucchini or whatever, go ahead and plant it, and then pick it and donate it to your local food bank, pantry. Maybe there's a shelter in your neighborhood, or just anywhere that where people are hungry.
And we know that there's a lot of pressure right now on the food banks around the state of Maine. We'd really appreciate your donation.
And the thing is, fresh food is such a joy at the food banks, because a lot of the food that the food banks do get is not fresh. It's you know, packaged food, it's preserved food, or it's canned food. And especially now with all the funds being as tight as they are, something fresh out of the garden, oh, what a joy that is.
We know that there's a lot of concern about the monarch butterfly, and that people are really interested in helping the monarch as well as other butterfly species. And I'm sure you are getting a lot of questions about how do I plant a pollinator garden? The answer always starts with milkweed, but that's not the end of the story, right, Lynn?
Absolutely not. And the monarch is sort of like the poster child of the pollinator garden, but there are so many insects nowadays that are really being hurt because they don't have any food. A lot of the plants that we see in the big box stores, etc., don't produce pollen. It's been bred out of them. But if you plant native plants, it has pollen and nectar that our native insects can use. And we need those insects and those pollinators, because about 30% of our food is dependent on it. So we do have a pollinator-friendly gardening website and a course, and you can find out just what plants are going to be the most pollinator-friendly. And generally speaking, it's probably a plant that you might even look at as kind of being a weed. It's probably not a weed, it's probably a wildflower. Weed is always a matter of opinion, but you know, it's going to be a plant that is going to be pretty easy to take care of. It's going to be pretty resilient, and it's probably going to be pretty happy to be in your garden.
Gary.
Yeah, I was just going to mention another really great source to figure out what native plants will work in your garden is what's called the Garden Plant Finder that the Native Plant Trust posts. And it gives you a chance to put in all of the potential factors that you need to know about to choose a good plant, including pollinator powerhouse plants, or they attract bees, or they're host plants for caterpillars. And it will come up with a list of plants that are for your ecoregion. And you can then go out and shop around and try to find them, because it gives you beautiful pictures of them. And you know, you can make some really good decisions based on that.
All right. Well, we're coming to the end of May, so maybe a little late to have this conversation, Gary, but I understand and I see on my social media feed that there are people I know who still believe in the concept of no mow May. And I see you nodding in sort of a frustrated way. This was a really popular idea a few years ago that seems to have taken hold, but it's not what you're recommending anymore, right? If somebody has a lawn, what are your recommendations for having a lawn that maybe is just a little more wildlife friendly than the traditional perfectly manicured lawn of the past?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's still a lot of people that are promoting it. I think it was a great idea to begin with, but after doing, you know, a little bit of research and even trying it myself for a couple of years, you realize that actually you're maybe setting back a lot of plants because you're letting them grow too tall and then you're cutting them way back and trying to turn it back into a lawn. And what works better if you have the room is to just let it become a wildflower field and then make a few mowed paths through it so you can still use the area and enjoy all of the wildlife that comes with those kinds of wildflower fields. Or if you want to keep it as a lawn, there was really good research that was done. There's a paper that's basically out there that is, you know, saying that the ideal for both the plants as well as for the pollinators is to mow every 2 weeks. So not after a whole month, every 2 weeks. If you've got a lawn that isn't just all grass, if you've got some of those things that Lynn called weeds earlier in that lawn, they might provide some pollen and nectar for a lot of different pollinators that might be out there, and you know, allow that to grow up for a couple weeks and then cut it back. And you know, I think that that's, you know, maybe a better way to go that was kind of proven through some really good research that was done at the University of Massachusetts.
All right. Before we go to the first break, Lynn, I want to ask you about something which I know is all the rage in gardening circles. And I know this from my husband, who is an avid gardener, the Chelsea chop. What is the Chelsea chop? Why are people so excited about the Chelsea chop? Why are you excited about the Chelsea chop?
Well,
we're not talking about karate.
No, we're not talking about karate, and we're not talking about a new knife technique in the kitchen. The Chelsea chop is for use with perennial plants. And you got to be kind of brave, because basically what you're doing is, about this time of year, you're going to take certain perennial plants and literally cut a half or a third off of them. And what that does is it sets the blooming back and it makes them grow bushier or branch out. And it also creates a bushier, more healthy plant in some situations. I, in fact, wrote an article for Maine Home Garden News, which gave the four different types of Chelsea chops. And the one that's most common is where you do cut a third to a half off. There's another one that's a little bit more drastic, where you actually cut after it's bloomed, the very early blooming perennials. And that's to encourage the growth for next year. But yeah, the reason they do it is basically to produce more foliage, and that produces more food for the plant, which produces a healthier plant.
We have a big patch of lemon queen, and he chops the front part so that the back blooms first and gets tall, and then the front blooms later, and it extends the season. Go on, Lynn. I think I cut you off. Sorry.
Yeah, and it's really good for use with native plants, because a lot of native plants get a little taller than people like in their garden. And so by doing it with a native plant, you can kind of get that 6-foot plant down to only 5 foot, or you know, maybe it's a little bushier as opposed to being tall and gangly. So that's why people are liking it, is because it gives you a little bit more control in the garden.
But when you say something native, you're talking about maybe some nice bee balm or aster, something like that.
Or a Joe pie weed or a ironweed, New York ironweed, that, you know, might be just a little taller than you like. Or asters or solidago, which we all know can get quite tall.
Oh boy. Well, we are speaking with Lynn Holland and Gary Fish. We are talking about gardening. And after the break, we are going to take your questions. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Here is your chance to get your gardening questions answered. With me today, Gary Fish, the Maine State Horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture Conservation and Forestry, and Lynn Holland, Horticulture and Social Media Professional at the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. You can share your comments and questions by email, a brief email please, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. And we will start with a call. Katie in Biddeford. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. And it's kind of a question and also maybe sort of a PSA. I was talking to an older gentleman this morning who was telling me about his yearly battle with bamboo. He was going out today to cut all the bamboo down that pops up every year, and it struck me that maybe he's talking about Japanese knotweed, and he was not familiar with Japanese knotweed. And I know it's a big problem here in Maine, so just I'm not sure if bamboo grows in Maine. I guess that's my question. And if not, everybody watch out for something that looks like bamboo.
That's right. And Gary, this is a perennial call on Maine Calling. And Katie, I appreciate it. The bane of so many gardeners in Maine. People do refer to Japanese knotweed as bamboo, correct?
They do. Some people call it Mexican bamboo. So there are some bamboos that are being sold and grown in Maine, but they are not an invasive problem at this point because they just don't do well. So there are some that we are looking at maybe banning in the future because they're running bamboos and they can become very invasive. But really what they're talking about when they say bamboo in Maine is knotweed or Japanese knotweed.
And this older gentleman that Katie's talking about who goes out and cuts it down, he's doing the right thing, isn't he? Just go cut it down. My husband's grandfather used to say, you got to worry it to death.
So the only way to kill it that way is through successive cuttings for many years. So it might take you 5 or 10 years to actually control it because you have to exhaust a very extensive, very deep root system with lots of rhizomes, and it will pop up here, there, and everywhere because it has that underground rhizome that carries it even 4 or 5 feet away. So, some people will cover it over with a tarp and lots of mulch on top and so on. But if you don't encircle it even an extra maybe 10 feet, it'll find its way beyond the tarp. It's a very tenacious plant. And in many instances, the only way to really manage it is to use an herbicide.
All right. Well, Katie, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to an email here from Brendan. Last year, red and gray squirrels and chipmunks ate every single peach on my tree. Any tips for thwarting the plundering? Lynn, I see you grinning, but also shrugging. That's a tough one, huh?
Yeah, well, we usually send all of our wildlife calls to APHIS.
What's APHIS?
That's the animal arm of the Wildlife Service. Gary, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, so the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service does have a wildlife damage control office that's in Sydney, Maine, and they can help to some degree. Harvesting earlier can help because, oftentimes they come right when they start to ripen, so you might want to harvest a little bit earlier and ripen it off the tree, which isn't quite as nice in terms of flavor, but it's something that you might be able to do. Another would be to use netting, net the whole tree, which can be difficult if it's a really big and tall tree. And, beyond that, looking at things that you might be doing to encourage them. So if you are feeding the birds, you're probably feeding the squirrels and the chipmunks, and you're going to bring them into your yard. That might be something that you could consider stopping. The other thing is, something that a lot of people don't like to hear about, but doing some trapping or something like that to try to reduce the populations. But if you live in Maine, you live in the woods, you're going to have those creatures, and you kind of have to learn to share with them, I think.
And this is one of those questions that I would not be surprised if a listener somebody emails in or calls in with a solution. So thank you for that question. We had a call who didn't have a great connection. This is Crystal. Crystal says, can you talk about the beech leaf blight that is attacking the Mid-Coast area? Gary, I see you nodding. You know about the beech leaf blight.
Yeah, so beech leaf disease is a new disease, not real new now. It's been, I think this is the fourth season it's been around. It's caused by a nematode, we think. It may have other associations, but it's caused by a nematode that we're starting to think actually moves with weather currents, because it came originally into Cleveland, Ohio, and it made it over to Maine within just a few years. And then it is now in every county but Franklin, and probably it's in Franklin as well. It's moving very quickly. We don't know exactly how it's going to end up with the trees. In Cleveland, where it's been there the longest, the younger trees are dying and the older trees are lasting even up to 7 or 8 years, but not looking very good. And the difference between there and here is that in Maine, we already have the beech bark disease, which is caused by another insect and disease association. And that stresses the trees quite badly. And then when they get beech leaf disease, it gets those bands in the leaves, and then they start to crinkle and fall, and it defoliates the tree multiple times. It first did hit kind of in the Mid-Coast area, Camden, Rockport area, but now it's pretty much throughout the state, and it's quite devastating and concerning.
An email here from Stephen. I've heard that rosemary can help repel ticks. How effective is it really? And are there other plants that work for better tick control in a garden or yard? Lynn, you're shaking your head.
No, we've done quite a bit of research at the University of Maine, and basically those homemade remedies are not really going to work well enough to keep those ticks away. There's a lot of good information, wearing protective clothing, basically doing prevention is the best way to keep the ticks away. And then doing a tick check afterwards. If you're going to be outside, you're going to be gardening, you're going to be mowing the lawn, walking the dog, whatever, do a tick check afterwards. It's just a few minutes, and it really is going to make a difference.
Gary?
Yeah, I think that you have to be really careful about the tick side of things, because they do carry so many different diseases. And there are a lot of products out there that are touting that they can manage ticks or keep them off from you, even like little tags that you wear and stuff like that. None of those have been proven to be effective, especially on ticks. Maybe some of them have been shown to work a little bit on mosquitoes and maybe black flies. But ticks are a completely different situation, and something that is very difficult to handle. And really, it's all about self-protection and doing tick checks, like Lynn said.
We'll go to Deb calling from Gouldsboro. Hi, Deb, go ahead.
we've been fighting mugwort with all of our energy, and we've tried spraying it with vinegar in the spring when it's warm, and it does seem to very locally burn it, but they run. It's like they have runners underground, and little ones you can't always catch. We've been weeding till our hands are exhausted. Is there anything you can do to control mugwort?
Lynn, what is mugwort and what do you do about it?
Well, mugwort is a pretty tenacious invasive plant. And when you spray it with vinegar, you probably just get it mad because it burns the top leaves, but then those roots are just going to throw up some new shoots somewhere else. Basically, I would say you could smother it, but then eventually you are going to have to get those roots out of the ground. And or that's almost one where I would say, if you're willing to use an herbicide, using that herbicide late in the fall or the late summer, early fall, to kill it when the plant is taking its energy down into the root system, because you're going to have to kill the root system.
There you go, Deb. Let's see, an email from Randall. Can I plant clover as a lawn replacement? Gary, you like this question.
I do. So clover is a great plant to mix in with other grass species. So it can be very helpful. Planting it just alone as a turf, not quite as great because it won't do quite so well in all those different areas. It really is more something that you add to a grass seed mix at maybe 5 or 10% of the mix, and then it can help to feed the grasses because it is a legume, and it will add nitrogen to the soil on its own. And so that's kind of the way that it works. I think that most people that try to do it all on its own as a turf end up not being very happy with it.
All right. We'll go to Liz calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question regarding a wild plant that grows along Route 1 all over the place in late July, early fall. And it is, you can see it along Route 1 at the quarry in Rockland. You can see it all around the Best Farm Stand signs. It's about an 8-foot high composite yellow flower. I thought it was tick seed when I did a little check on my phone. No, that's too low. I thought maybe it was Jerusalem artichoke. Don't think it's that. So I'm wondering if anybody knows.
Gary, Lynn, you guys know what she's talking about? Tall. So tall and yellow, Liz?
Is it a daisy-like flower?
It kind of is. It's all yellow. It doesn't have sort of a central. Anybody that goes up and down Route 1 in July or August in the Mid-Coast will see them sprouting everywhere. Those are just two locations that they're easily always seen. And so I was just wondering if I want to get some. I think they're good for native habitats, for butterflies and stuff. I don't know what they are to get.
Neither one of our experts is sure, Liz. I think they'd need to see a picture. Sorry about that. I'm going to go to Helen here. I was dismayed to find woolly adelgid on both of my hemlock trees in Portland for the first time this spring. Would it help to cut off infested twigs and branches, or should I wait until August when crawlers are dormant? Thoughts about hemlock woolly adelgid, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to move it when the crawlers are active. So that's something that isn't a good idea to cut off and move anywhere else. It is something that can be treated with like dormant oils. There's a dormant oil spray that can be done at a time when the crawlers are moving. There's also a tree injection that can be done to help to control them. It is too bad to see that. It is something that if you start cutting a whole bunch of the tree off, eventually you get to the point where there's not anything left. So it's probably better for the tree to treat it one way or another, as opposed to try to do that. There are beneficial organisms that are being released by the Forest Service that hopefully in the future will catch up and reduce the overall damage from those little adelgids, but it probably won't help a tree that's infested right now.
All righty, I want to go to a question here. Let's see. From Bruce, my dad was a teacher in Massachusetts, but also had a landscaping business full-time in summer. It was just garden design. Our yard was dense with azaleas and rhodies, even more than the botanical gardens in Booth Bay. Up here in Maine, I've been able to grow a few more of the Zone 6 and 7 shrubs and trees. What are some of varieties that now survive well here that haven't in the past? I've also become a huge fan of container gardening to cut down on maintenance and bring some color to the deck and patio. Still battling the burning bush, Euonymus alata as well. So back to the core of his question here, Lynn, is that we know that the hardiness map has shifted officially. What are you finding that gardeners that work with the Cooperative Extension can grow now that they haven't been able to before? And I know Maine is a huge state and there's not one thing or another that fits everywhere, but maybe some examples of something that's growing somewhere that wouldn't have 20 years ago?
Boy, that's a hard one because it's so dependent on who you talk to and where they live. Like, I find there's some bushes that I've had that have just done better, as opposed to not necessarily something that's new that I've tried. And I think that's something to think about also.
What are those? What are your bushes that are thriving more now?
Well, for instance, there's a Kalmia. It's the Oregon holly, and I can't think of the botanical name, but it has a blue berry. It's a holly like leaf, green, shiny, yellow flowers though. And when I first lived here, if you got a berry, you were lucky, because the flowers just would get frosted right over. But now it's like constant. Every year you get a bunch of berries. My butterfly bushes always survive now, where it was hit or miss. Some of the clematis would, die back after 3 years. Some of the certain types of hydrangeas would die back after a year or two, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it does depend on your microclimate, even within your community. So, Lynn, thank you so much. Those are some great examples. I know how much people love butterfly bush, for example. If you have a gardening question, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send an email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are getting answers to your gardening questions. With me, Gary Fish, state horticulturist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, and Lynn Holland, horticulture and social media professional at the UMaine Cooperative Extension. Share your comments and questions, but be quick. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, Gary, we were talking about how the hardiness zones have shifted and what plants might be doing better now than before. And you have a couple to add to the list.
Yeah, one of the small trees that's really pretty this time of year are just starting to go by is redbuds. So redbuds haven't been doing all that well, throughout Maine for many years, but they're doing a lot better now. And one that's really neat that has a neat association with a great insect is the spice bush. So it's not a real big tree. It's kind of a small tree, big shrub. And both of those are doing much better now.
Mm, yeah. Oh, boy, they're both pretty, too. We'll go to Maggie from York Beach. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is, I've always used very sparingly Roundup to take care of particularly that viney with the pink flower on it. It's all over the place. It infests my plants. That does not exist anymore, and I know it's terrible. I bought something called Deadweed Brew, and I noticed it killed it within a day, but it doesn't kill the root. And I am so infested with weeds. It's crazy. My next question is, when you mulch, does that take care of or get rid of the growth of weeds, or does that just perpetuate it?
Gary.
This is a great question and one that a lot of people have. And so, Roundup still exists. It's still out there. It's still something that, yes, is controversial, and you'll read all kinds of things on social media about it and that it causes this and everything else. It, according to every country across the world, they have not banned this because there is no proof that it causes cancer or anything like that. If it's used properly and you're not bathing in it, it doesn't have a high risk. It does work very well for a lot of perennial plants that are deep rooted, like knotweed that we were talking about earlier. So it can be a solution. In fact, it can be less disruptive than pulling plants out or covering them over. You can plant right after you apply it pretty much as soon as it's dry. So you can replace that plant with something else that's even better. And something like the Deadweed Brew that everybody's wondering about and think it's wonderful because it's maybe from natural sources. Just because it's natural doesn't make it better or safer. And all it does, just like with vinegar, it kills the top of the plant. So if it's a deep-rooted perennial, it's going to keep coming back year after year. In terms of mulch,
on this program before, you've talked about, when you've talked about using something like Roundup, you've talked about maybe taking a paintbrush and you know, cutting off the plant you don't want, the weed, and then just dipping right where the cut is a little bit of Roundup right onto the stem.
Yeah, they're
not,
very
not
strategic.
Spraying a large area, but being very precise.
There are very strategic ways of using it and reducing the amount that you use and, you know, making sure that you are following the label carefully and not getting it on you or other things, other plants. So it can be done in a way that reduces the risk to you, to the environment, to other plants that may be nearby, and it can be very helpful. In terms of mulch, you know, mulch does help. Mulch can help exclude some weeds, and it has to be done properly. You don't want to do mulch volcanoes where you're putting a lot of mulch up against the stem of a plant or something like that. You don't want to have more than maybe 3 inches of mulch unless you're doing this just for weed control and there's no plants in that bed. You could go as much as 6 inches deep and that would help. What happens though sometimes with mulch, depending upon where you get it from, is that it may be infested with weed seed and then you get weeds from the mulch. One of the worst ones is horsetail. So water horsetail is it's a native plant, but it's been easily spread around with mulch and can become really tenacious and be a big problem. So anytime you import something into your garden, you're taking a risk. You could be getting jumping worms, you could be getting some sort of disease, you could be getting some sort of, you know, weed. You always have to think about the, you know, calculated risk of bringing something new into your garden. So if you can make your own mulch, that's better. Yeah.
And something we've talked about before, and Lynn, I don't know what your opinion is on this, but I have a feeling I know. So many of the mulches you buy today are dyed. That black mulch that everybody likes is often not even natural, right? It's a ground up construction debris. That to get a pine bark mulch is so much more beneficial from your garden to get something that has been dyed black or brown, correct?
Yeah, and what Gary was saying about not bringing stuff in, I mean, if you have to take down a tree or have a bunch of branches, just chip those up and put them in a pile and then use that as your mulch. You know where they came from. That's so important. You know, people poo-poo lawn clippings, but lawn clippings aren't a bad thing to have in certain areas using as a mulch. You know, for certain conditions, it can keep the weeds down, especially annual weed seeds. And if something should sprout in there, it's real easy to pull it up because it can't take hold. So, I mean, if you can use mulches that are not too thick, like Gary said, you're not going to get anything sprouting up. And if you have a perennial weed, don't mulch it. It's just going to make it mad.
We'll go to AMK, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Wondering if there's a way to mitigate an explosion of cat o' nine tails in the creek that runs behind our home into a pond. We live in Scarborough, so now the water table is getting higher and higher as the creek is getting choked off and the culverts under the road. So I'm wondering if there is a way to get them to go away.
Interesting question. Cat o' nine tails. That's a first, AMK. Either of you have thoughts on that?
Well, this is an area where you really need to work with maybe the Natural Resources Conservation Service or someone that really understands water and ponds. If you start ripping them out, oftentimes they will come back again. They're kind of like a knotweed. They have a deep root and they're a perennial plant. And in some instances, people have had to use herbicides to try to control them. But in water situations, you can't do that without hiring someone that's licensed and that also gets a special permit to do that kind of work. It is difficult. It is something that Some pond owners will actually scarify that area year after year, but usually that's like a private pond that they can let the water level go really low and then do the work at that time so that they're not causing water quality problems. And there, I would recommend that that person contact someone at Cooperative Extension or DEP that might, you know, be able to guide them with some ways of managing that if it's on their own property.
Good
luck
to you.
There used to be a good program at Cooperative Extension, but I'm not sure that's staffed anymore.
Yeah, AMK, good luck to you. We're going to go to Steve calling from Buckfield. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I'm wondering about trying to beat back the squash bugs. I've tried, general sanitation, diatomaceous earth, neem. And the other problem I'm having is with tiny little holes in my peaches.
Steve, Lynn, I'm going to say to you, Steve, ask some of the tough questions. Go ahead.
Well, with the squash bugs, it's a continuous battle. And basically, hygiene in the garden is a big deal. If you can move it to a place where you haven't had squash before, that's the first thing I'm going to tell you to do, because that's going to help. Other than that, it's just going to be picking them. They're there. It's kind of like the bean beetles. You can't get away from them. The holes in your peaches, that's a different problem. Are they the big holes or tiny holes?
I can't hear him, but the note to me says little pinholes.
Ooh. Gary, you got any ideas on that?
Well, I'm wondering if that's some sort of either maggot or caterpillar, and we'd have to see something about that.
Yeah.
In terms of like the squash bugs, one other thing you can do, and you can do this for slugs and other things, is you can put out boards or pieces of newspaper and very religiously go out every day, lift them up and kill what's underneath them, because oftentimes it's slugs and squash bugs. Or you can also find their eggs on the undersides of the leaves and squish them. So that's another way to kind of slow them down, but they are very difficult to manage. And like Lynn said, it's most important to rotate and get out of the area where you've been growing them if you can.
Okay, Steve, good luck to you. I'm trying to get a couple more questions in from Lindy in email. How do I safely remove poison ivy? My husband and little boys seem to be able to get it just by looking at it.
That's a good one. Well, you can't get it by looking at it. Often you get it from your pet. So your dog or cat goes out and gets the oil on their fur, and then you pat them and you get it on your skin, and then you get the allergic reaction. So with poison ivy, poison ivy is a really important native plant. It is a great pollinator plant. I've got some great pictures of bees going to poison ivy flowers. It's also produces some white berries that are really nutritious for birds and small mammals. So it's not a plant that you want to control unless people are getting into it. So when they get into it, you can, if you're not allergic to it, you can protect yourself and pull it out and keep pulling it out, and that will eventually exhaust the root system. Or again, this is one that oftentimes people resort eventually to using an herbicide, because it is a very deep-rooted perennial plant that is really hard to control just by pulling and pulling and pulling.
We'll go to Nan calling from Hollowell. Hi, Nan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a butterfly bush that I planted a couple of years ago, and it bloomed profusely for the last 2 years. This year, coming into spring, I clipped the buds off, the old buds, and I noticed on the main stems there, it looked like there were buds on them, but they were kind of a grayish color, and it almost looked like they were dead.
So, Nana, I'm going to have to cut you off and get an answer from one of our guests very quickly, because we're almost at the end of the program. Who has butterfly bush advice?
I have some advice. Don't plant it anymore because it's an invasive plant. it is one that is not as hardy, so you're going to have a hard time keeping it coming back. And, you know, maybe doing some strategic pruning will help, but it is one that eventually we probably will end up banning as an invasive plant.
All right. Well, there's our last question. Thank you all. And I apologize to anybody whose question we didn't get to, but you can always contact the UMaine Cooperative Extension with your question. Right, Lynn? She says, right, yeah. Lynn Holland, horticulture and social media professional at the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Gary Fish, Maine's state horticulturist. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the culture of sharing meals in Maine. We're talking about potlucks and bean suppers and why they are good for us and not just because they fill our belly. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.